The Years of Lyndon Johnson, Means of Ascent, by Robert A. Caro. Continued, Cassette 10, Side 2. Early in August 1948, Attorney General Tom Clark's brother Robert, a Dallas lawyer who represented the men who controlled that time slot, approached Lyndon Johnson with a simple proposal. They would support him and give him the time slot if he used it to deliver Pappy's speech as if it were his own. Of course, Clark explained, they didn't want him to give the speech just once. They wanted him to give it over and over, day after day, every day until Election Day, just the way Pappy would have done it. Lyndon would not even have to write it, they said. Pappy's old speechwriters would write it. All Johnson would have to do was read it over and over as evidence of his good faith, as public proof that he truly subscribed to Pappy's philosophy, which was, of course, their philosophy. Horace Busby was in Amarillo with Johnson, staying in the same hotel, when the candidate received the first script. Having known nothing of Clark's proposal, the young aide had been surprised when he had noticed in the schedule that Johnson was to give a speech in that prized time slot. No campaigning had been arranged for that morning, as Busby recalls. He had a morning alone. Busby was in his own room, and Johnson summoned him. When he arrived, the candidate was looking through the script. It was as though he had no life in him, Busby recalls. He would sit down at a table, and he would turn the pages. He would get up and pace and sit down again. Finally, Busby says, he motioned me over and said, "Look at this stuff." Busby read the speech. He cannot recall the exact words, but Busby says, it equated unionism with mobs, all about goons and goon squads and pineapples, grenades being thrown into the homes of honest union reformers and extortion. The language was very rough. I don't know about that, Johnson said. Sometimes politics asks too much. For what Busby describes as an extended period of time, the candidate was going through just an intense personal debate with himself. He paced back and forth, stopping every so often and staring at the ceiling, absent-mindedly jingling the change in his pocket, as if unable to decide whether or not to give the speech. He gave Busby some of the background. He named the men who were involved. He never said exactly what they had done. They had bought the time. They had put up the money. He said some of the largest employers in Texas had done this, had defected from Coke and said if he would do these speeches, that they would not only pay for it, but that they would go to work with their people and get a turnout. All the arrangements had been made, he said. In fact, one of Carr Collins's men was downstairs to handle the broadcast. But repeating that sometimes politics asks too much of a man, he also said several times, I'm going to call Bob Clark and tell him to forget it. That call was not made. Instead, there followed what Busby calls the rationalizing. Johnson said to me, that man, coaxed Stevenson, ought not to be senator. He's the kind of isolationist who got us into this war, and he'll get us into another one. The labor unions should not be supporting a man like Coke Stevenson, who was against everything they were for. The unions were selling out the working people. Suppose he refused to give the speech, he said. What would happen? Well, what it comes down to, Buzz, is this. I can refuse to make the speech, and when I'm out of office, I can go over to the union headquarters in Washington and tell them what a noble thing I did. And when I get over there, the receptionist is going to say, Lyndon who? And she's going to call upstairs, and then she's going to say, who are you with? And then she's going to say, I'm sorry, but there's no one who can see you. And there followed what Ed Clark and others familiar with Johnson would call the working himself up, getting himself not only to believe what he was saying, but to believe it enthusiastically. He went off on a kind of rights of the people soliloquy. Does Coke Stevenson care about the man who works for a living? The unions were selling out the working people. He really got pretty steamed up thinking his way through about the working people. When he had finished, Johnson picked up the script and walked out to give the broadcast. Busby, who believed he was so expert at reading Johnson's moods, knew that when he pushed his hat back, he was in a good mood. To Busby's surprise, understandable surprise in view of the intense personal debate he had just witnessed, as Johnson picked up the script, he pushed his hat back. Also, to my surprise, Busby, listening to the broadcast, realized that he didn't try to cover up on any of the offending lines, that in fact, he was expressive, reading the script very well, better than he read most speeches. The reactionaries had demanded a stiff price for their support. Johnson paid it in full. The response was all the candidate could have wished. Following the speech, he returned to the hotel, and again while Busby was present, there was a call from Bob Clark. Bob Clark had a gathering, and I could tell from Lyndon's end of the conversation that everything had gone well. And he was speaking with enormous respectfulness to them, and they were saying, "We never expected you to do it, but you can count on us." And there were more calls that night. The talk brought the ultra-conservatives in behind him. They just, in effect, joined the campaign. This gave a beneficial turn. Before the end of the week, I felt enough electricity in the air that I thought we could win. And he did, too. The polls showed that Johnson was indeed gaining. Now, when he called to ask John Connolly, "What do you hear?" Connolly had good news to report. Particularly when Johnson got on the radio with the labor stuff, they, the polls, showed Johnson gaining, he recalls. The trend was especially strong in rural areas. Connolly, an expert on rural voting, felt that the O'Daniel time slot and the O'Daniel speech that Johnson was making in it was, day by day, greatly increasing his share of the rural vote. Johnson's presence in the O'Daniel slot was a signal to Texas conservatives that he was approved by the conservative upper echelons. So the broadcasts, Busby says, turned money that would have gone to Stevenson. Since the former governor's campaign financing had always come from conservatives, the flow of Stevenson's funds, already drastically reduced, was cut off almost entirely. This, as Busby says, was important, because by the middle of August, Coke Stevenson had had enough. For 3 months, Stevenson's advisors had been pleading with him to defend himself against Johnson's attacks, trying to make him understand that Johnson was hurting his reputation, and in the last few weeks also telling him that Johnson was pulling dangerously close. For 3 months, they had been pleading with him with increasing urgency to attack Johnson, to make the public examine his record. For 3 months, Stevenson had refused to do so. Two new developments appear to have made him change his mind. One was the insinuation that he was a communist tool. According to one aide, the turning point came when, in a small town one day in early August, a farmer handed him a copy of the Johnson Journal. The other was the realization that although attacks on his reputation had never worked before, Johnson's attacks were working. The Texans were coming to believe that he was a communist front, a do-nothing governor who had accomplished nothing for the state, and an opportunistic politician without firm principles or beliefs who would trim his sails to the prevailing wind. After a grim meeting at Center, George Petty's hometown, where 25 key Petty supporters told him, "Coke, this thing is a lot closer than you think," Stevenson agreed to say the things his supporters had for so long been wanting him to say. He said them in two speeches in East Texas, each delivered in the traditional setting, on the lawn of a courthouse in a county seat, one in Center and one in Conroe. Despite the blazing heat, he spoke with his suit jacket on and buttoned. The speeches combined a defense of his record with questions about Johnson's. "I don't like to make speeches like this," Coke Stevenson said. He had never made a charge against any of my opponents. But, he said, "since things were said of me, I'd like to ask a few questions." And the questions he asked were the ones his advisors had been begging him to ask, the questions that had never been asked in public about Lyndon Johnson. First, Stevenson listed 7 major topics that Johnson himself had said urgently needed, and had needed for some time, national action. An increase in old-age pensions, construction of more farm-to-market roads, control of inflation, reductions in income taxes, conservation of soil and water, control of communist activities, investigation of communist espionage. During his 11.5 years in Congress, Coke Stevenson asked, had Lyndon Johnson ever taken any action on any of these problems? More specifically, had he ever introduced legislation that addressed any of these problems? Stevenson went through them one by one. "When Lyndon Johnson had appeared before you," Coke Stevenson reminded his audience, "when he landed his helicopter on this very spot," the congressman had talked, as he had been talking throughout the campaign, about the need for farm-to-market roads. "Well," Stevenson said, "during his own administration as governor, hundreds, thousands of miles of farm-to-market roads had been built all over Texas." "But," he asked his audience, "when Johnson spoke to you, did he mention anything he had ever done to get farm-to-market roads built? And specifically, did Johnson tell you he had ever introduced a bill to help with the farm-to-market road program?" "When Johnson spoke to you," Stevenson said, "he talked about the need for increased old-age pensions. Well, during his own administration as governor, old age pensions had been tripled. Did Johnson mention anything he had ever done to get pensions increased? And specifically, did Johnson tell you he had ever introduced a bill on the subject of old age pensions? Stevenson went through the other topics in similar detail. During his 11 and a half years in Congress, he asked, had Lyndon Johnson taken any action on such national problems? Had he introduced any bills to deal with them? And Stevenson asked a larger question. When he was here, Coke Stevenson asked, did my opponent tell you that he ever introduced any such bill in his entire life? Did he mention any law he offered in the 11 and one-half years he has been in Congress, any bill for the general welfare? When my opponent landed his helicopter on this very spot, did he tell you of any bill he ever introduced in Congress? Did he ever pass a bill which would aid the average citizen of the United States? Did he ever introduce a bill? A single bill? I can't find one. I can't find a single bill to help the average citizen that Lyndon Johnson introduced in 11 and one-half years. Ask him if he ever introduced a bill. I don't like to make speeches like this, Stevenson repeated. I'm just giving you my record and contrasting it with the absence of a record for the other candidate. I'm just asking you if he had told you about introducing any legislation, and I think the answer is no. When for the first time public emphasis was placed on Lyndon Johnson's legislative record, the phrase summarizing that record, or the lack of it, was so dramatic that it leapt out of newspaper articles, even in pro-Johnson papers. In the strongest speech of his entire campaign, Coke Stevenson lambasted his opponent, Lyndon Johnson, and demanded to know of one single bill Congressman Johnson ever introduced in Congress, reported the Houston Post. The lead in the Dallas News said, Lyndon Johnson, in 11 and a half years in Congress, never introduced a single bill which would contribute to the welfare of the people, Coke Stevenson charged. Some version of the phrase, not one single bill in 11 and one-half years, appeared in virtually every daily newspaper in Texas. During the next few days, moreover, Stevenson began to focus on aspects not only of Johnson's past record, but of his present campaign. It is no secret to any informed person that the other candidate is waging what is probably the most expensive political campaign in the history of Texas, he said on August 19th. Where, he asked, was this money coming from, and why? Could his money, he asked, be coming from a few millionaires who owe him past political debts and hope for future political favors from him? Stevenson even hinted, accurately, at another source of Johnson's money. Could it be coming from the CIO? Indeed, he said, part of the huge expenditures to elect Lyndon Johnson to federal office were being made with what were, in the last analysis, federal taxes. As for himself, Stevenson said, he had kept his own campaign on a very modest scale, as he had in the past. I've never had a sideshow or a brass band in my campaign. I was raised up in the ranch country, where a man is known for his character and the adornments he has, not the adornments he could buy. But, he said, he did not believe that Johnson's expenditures would make any difference. He believed that Texans would have enough intelligence to understand why the contractors and Hughes Aircraft were supporting Johnson. And he believed that Texans understood that he, Coke Stevenson, would never be an errand boy for contractors or oil companies. I do not believe you are ready to sell the office of United States Senator to the highest bidder, he said. I do not believe you want as your senator a man who is able to call on secret sources for the multiplied millions of dollars that are being spent on behalf of the other candidate. These statements, too, received good play. Good, but brief. Too brief to be effective. Repetition, that was the thing, Paul Bolton says, and the Johnson speechwriter is right. For Stevenson's charges to have significant impact on the campaign, Stevenson would have to repeat them in a series of radio speeches and in advertisements on the radio and in newspapers, daily and weekly. They would have to be repeated in mailings of postcards and letters and brochures. They would have to be repeated in conversations, the conversations of travelers and other campaign workers. Stevenson's advisers wanted repetition. Now that the old man had finally agreed to attack, they eagerly anticipated putting the attack on the air. But airtime cost money. Boyette and Roberts asked for money from the conservative businessmen who had previously backed Koch's campaigns, but their contributions, already slowed by the doubts Johnson had planted about Stevenson's stance on Taft-Hartley, had all but dried up because these were the men, many of them from Dallas, who had listened with Robert Clark to Lyndon Johnson reading Pappy's speech. During the last 10 days of the campaign, Stevenson was indeed on the radio, but not often enough, and except in a few instances, not to a sufficiently large audience. "We would have a statewide radio address scheduled," Boyette recalls, "but often there would not be enough to pay all the stations to carry it. Frantically, he and other Stevenson loyalists would telephone county managers and ask them to raise the money to pay for their local station to carry it, but all too often this didn't work either. We would have to cut off stations." Stevenson's speech on Johnson's huge expenditures, for example, was scheduled for statewide airing at 6:45 p.m. August 19th, but at the last minute so many stations cut it off the air that substantial parts of the state never heard it. Stevenson's advisors had anticipated examining Johnson's record as a congressman in a newspaper advertising campaign, and effective ads were written and designed. One asked Johnson, "If you have energy, initiative, and independent judgment, please refer us to one piece of legislation passed by the Congress during your 11 1/2 years that bears your name." But the number of such ads that appeared was pathetically small compared with the volume of Johnson ads that were appearing everywhere. Bolton was right. Repetition, that was the thing. But Johnson had turned his opponent's money. His opponent couldn't afford repetition. The concept, "not one single bill in 11 1/2 years, was a dramatic one, but it would not become generally known to the voters of Texas, because there was no money to make it known. Connolly, "you have to say something over and over to get voters to be aware of it," explains scornfully. "So Koch makes a speech. So what? With one speech you couldn't sell anyone that Johnson wasn't an activist in the Congress. He had a reputation of being an activist. One day play is all you get out of any speech. He didn't make a big issue out of it. So the press might be aware of it, they might write a story about it, but nobody knew about it. With one speech, you can't sell anyone." Under the old politics, Stevenson's charges, even without massive funds to publicize them, would have had a more substantial impact on the campaign. Under the old politics, radio, the prime consumer of campaign funds, was not nearly so great a factor, so stump speeches and newspaper articles had a greater relative importance, and good, if brief, newspaper play would have had more of an effect on a campaign. Limited though his airtime might be, the disparity between it and his opponents would not have been so disproportionate. But this was the new politics, media politics, money politics, Lyndon Johnson politics. During the last 2 weeks of the campaign, despite the dropping of stations from his network broadcasts, most areas of Texas heard Koch Stevenson at least 3 or 4 times. Occasionally, one of Stevenson's supporters was on the air. Occasionally, there were in the big newspapers a few ads repeating his charges. During these last 2 weeks, Lyndon Johnson was on the air in every section of Texas at 3 regular times a day, every day, not only in Pappy's old 12:30 slot, but at 7:40 in the morning and 7:30 in the evening. By mid-August, a Texas farm family had difficulty sitting down to a meal and switching on the radio without hearing his voice. Transcribed 4-minute recordings were on the air at other times. His supporters were on the air, frequently on statewide networks, so often that, as one observer recalls, it seemed like you could hardly turn on the radio without hearing about Lyndon Johnson. With the campaign roaring to a climax and newspapers focusing on it, news coverage of the candidates in newspapers was now fairly equal. But newspaper advertising was overwhelmingly Johnson's, and in many weekly newspapers this space was as influential with readers as the articles, because the newspapers did not differentiate much between the two, and many unsophisticated readers couldn't tell the difference anyway. As for direct mailings, Stevenson had few, if any. Rural mailboxes were filled daily not only with the Johnson Journal, but with mailing after mailing of letters and postcards. And always, of course, there was the conversational campaigning, the work of the travelers. Only a massive barrage of Stevenson ads and mailings and walking delegates could have countered this, and there was no money to pay for them. Stevenson's charges did not bother John Connolly for a moment. "So Koch makes a speech. So what?" Connolly's assessment of the situation was correct. Koch Stevenson had made charges about Lyndon Johnson, several charges. In effect, these charges went unheard. His charge that Johnson was, with his huge expenditures, trying to buy the campaign, was drowned out, as were all his charges. by Johnson's huge expenditures. There may have been another reason, too, that Coke Stevenson's attacks did not have greater impact on the campaign. During the first primary, George Petty had commented on what he called a strange coincidence. In a radio address that he had hoped would provide a major boost to his candidacy, Petty had advocated an increase in old age pensions. On the very evening on which he made the address, however, Lyndon Johnson took much of the impact out of Petty's proposal by making a similar proposal, in almost the same words. Now others began to notice the same kind of coincidences. On August 18th, for example, Stevenson said that he was no new recruit in the fight against communism. Almost simultaneously, Johnson was on the radio. "I am no recent convert to the fight against communism," he said. On August 19th, as Texas political historian Seth McKay puts it, "Curiously, the two campaigners on the same day accused one another of the same bad practices," in almost the same words. In his speech in Austin that day, which claimed that Johnson's supporters were waging what is probably the most expensive political campaign in the history of Texas, Stevenson added that money was being spent like water to defeat him. That same day in Fort Worth, Johnson said in a radio speech that Stevenson's supporters were spending money like water to defeat him. The coincidences went beyond phrasing. Meeting at the Driscoll Hotel to plan strategy, Stevenson's inner circle of advisors had gradually come to realize that their plans were known outside the room almost as soon as they made them, although their only communication with the outside world had been over the telephone. Stevenson's schedule, for example, seemed to be known throughout Texas political circles even before it had been published, within minutes, in fact, after it had been decided on, although Boyette says, "During those minutes, the only time the schedule had been discussed was on the phone. We were absolutely certain that they were wiretapping our headquarters in the Driscoll." Asked about this, Connolly has said, "We didn't do any wiretapping. We said that during the 1940s, they didn't tap and tape like they do now." He also said, "Occasionally we would have a telephone operator, on our own, listen in and tell us what was being said." In those days, that was what happened. Operators would listen in on the switchboard. Connolly added, "We may have had somebody in his headquarters reporting to us." Was there, in fact, someone spying in Stevenson's headquarters? "I don't remember," Connolly replied. Other members of the campaign, however, believed that the phone lines of Stevenson's headquarters were being constantly listened to, either by tapping or by operators listening in. The repetition of speech themes and phrases by Johnson, whether based on overheard telephone calls or not, whether repeated the same or the next day, took the edge off Stevenson's belated efforts to attack, or at least to defend himself, against his younger opponent. On August 19th, for example, Stevenson made the point that Johnson's attempts to give himself a new ultra-conservative image squared poorly with his previous alliances with ultra-liberals in Washington. Stevenson pointed out that Henry Wallace had actively supported Johnson in his previous Senate race in 1941, and had even loaned one of his chief aides, Harold Young, to the Johnson campaign as a fundraiser to obtain large sums of money from labor leaders in the North. "Are they still together to the extent that the money they are spending is coming from the same source?" Stevenson asked. This charge, which was accurate, might have been a telling point, but the next day Johnson stated that it was actually Stevenson and Wallace who were secret allies. In radio broadcasts that day, he demanded, "What promises of support did he, Stevenson, extract from Henry Wallace when Wallace cooled coffee with him in the governor's mansion back in 1944? Wallace had visited the governor that year during a tour of the Southwest. And Johnson added, "I see that the black bag of the labor bosses has finally arrived from the North to swell the slush fund being spent to defeat Lyndon Johnson." As the Corpus Christi Caller Times commented, "The question by Johnson pushed the political merry-go-round full circle and left each candidate implying the other was, or had been, associated with the head of the Progressive Party." Who could blame voters, even those who were conscientiously attempting to follow the campaign, for being confused, and in a sea of identical charges by both candidates, for being convinced by the candidate who could, thanks to the power of money, make the charge so much more frequently than his opponent? During the crucial month of August, Lyndon Johnson even made use of his most reluctant weapon. Months earlier, at the very beginning of the campaign, Johnson had personally ordered cards and placards with pictures of Lady Bird and his two daughters, and had commented with satisfaction upon seeing the finished product, Coke can't do that. In competing for the women's vote, he had told aides frankly, he possessed a significant advantage. He had a wife, and Stevenson didn't. Attempts to maximize this asset had proven unsatisfactory during the first primary, because the confidence which Lady Bird Johnson had gained as a result of managing a congressional office and a business had not carried over into the area of her greatest timidity. In the hectic swirl of Johnson campaign headquarters, the one constant was Mrs. Johnson's calm, warm smile. When, on her husband's rare days in Austin, staff members arrived at Dillman Street for an evening or a late-night meeting, they had learned to accept as a matter of course the graciousness of her welcome, and no matter how late the hour, a hot meal. Sometimes she quoted Kipling, "If you can keep your head while..." And, says Dorothy Nichols, during the frantic dark days of 1948, "I really believed she lived by that poem. She doesn't lose her head." Suitcases packed with her husband's medical supplies and carefully starched shirts were ready every time Woody screeched up to her door. But despite her husband's increasingly insistent demands that she make speeches, or at least personal appearances, on his behalf, during the first primary she had not done so. Her terrible shyness had always made public appearances of even the most undemanding variety such an ordeal that her friends had suffered for her on the rare occasions when she had been induced to stand beside her husband on a receiving line at some 10th District event, and a bright smile set rigidly on her face, shake hands and try to chat with strangers filing by. As for making a speech, the very suggestion that she face an audience brought panic to the face of this woman who had once prayed for smallpox so that she wouldn't have to speak at her high school graduation ceremony. Although Mrs. Johnson was willing to do almost anything for her husband, making speeches was one thing she would not do, felt she could not do. There was, moreover, another impediment to her campaigning. Because of Texas's vast distances, personal campaigning, even appearing at receptions, involved airplane travel, and Mrs. Johnson was almost as afraid of flying as of speaking in public. She was often not only in terror, but violently airsick as well. Finally, near the end of the first primary campaign, Alvin Wirtz, who always had more influence with her than any other of her husband's associates, suggested a way in which she might need at least a few voters. Why not drive from gas station to gas station, purchasing only 5 gallons of gas at each stop, and meet the gas station owners and the hangers-on who were often around rural gas stations? This Mrs. Johnson finally agreed to do, as long as she didn't have to do it alone, and Mary Rather was deputed to accompany her. But this attempt lasted only a day or two. Then one morning, as they were pulling into their third gas station, Lady Bird said to Miss Rather, "You ask them this time, Mary. I don't believe I can do it again." After the first primary, however, there was only 1 month to go, and his wife's fears were no longer a luxury that Lyndon Johnson was prepared to indulge. "We need to get after the women's vote," Johnson told Busby. He told Lady Bird's friend Marietta Brooks of Austin, who was active in a number of statewide women's clubs, to telephone leading club women throughout the state and organize coffees, at which Lady Bird would meet the local club women and give interviews to local reporters. And when aides ventured to mention that this would mean that Lady Bird would have to fly, Johnson said, "She'll fly." She did, perhaps as much out of concern about what the humiliation of overwhelming defeat would do to her husband as for any other reason. In recalling her reasons years later, she would say, "We were overwhelmingly, vastly, horribly behind." Overcoming Stevenson's huge margin looked hopeless, but at least I wanted to narrow that margin just as much as I could, and make just as much of a showing as I could for myself and for him and all those folks who had already shoveled so much love and sweat and time and money into it. Her first trip was to Corpus Christi on August 2nd. Mary Rather recalls that, "We were all fanning out in various directions over the state that Monday morning, and if any had had time, they would have felt sorry for Lady Bird as she took off through gray, rainy skies in a very small plane with one pilot and one traveling companion." Lady Bird was so nervous that she had written out and memorized every phrase she was to say in the Corpus Christi interview, and it showed. Asked if she thought helicopter campaigning was a good idea, she said she did because, "I think a candidate ought to let the voters see one and to hear one's ideas." She said a petty supporter had telephoned her to say 90% of the petty vote would go to Lyndon, and this was a very happy generalization that we are going to strive to make a fact. But it was an interview. It was publicity, a pleasant article and photograph in the Corpus Christi Caller. And although she took plane trips back and forth across Texas all during August, a month in which the intense heat spawned almost daily thunderstorms, and the terror and the air sickness never got better, the fear of interviews eased at least a little. After a while, Lady Bird was to say, she realized that these people are just like me, so I had no reason to be scared. She never became less modest in her statements, but she became more effective. In Fort Worth, on August 24th, she was still saying to a reporter, "My campaigning role is comparatively simple. I just pack and unpack and take care of Lyndon." But she was less reluctant to talk about herself, telling a reporter that she had studied to be a journalist herself but had gotten married instead. "So I became part of the news instead of reporting it." And, the reporter wrote, "Mrs. Lyndon Johnson, an attractive brunette whose roles as wife and mother have kept her in the background of her husband's public career, charmed 200 Tarrant County women at a coffee Wednesday morning." Soon, in fact, her husband's top advisors, receiving reports back in Austin on her appearances, realized that she was becoming quite an effective force in the campaign. For one thing, Edward Clark says, unlike her husband, she had never done anything unpopular. She had never done anything anyone could criticize. But Clark says it was more than that. She was a great asset. She made votes everywhere she went. One thing, however, she still resisted doing. When a reporter asked her that August if she planned to speak on her husband's behalf, she said, "I couldn't possibly make a speech." Her husband was particularly insistent that she make one at the opening rally of the second primary, the rally in Center in Deep East Texas. Since she was from that area, and since her father was a political force there, even a few words from her would be a big help. But she said she simply couldn't. In a maneuver conceived by her husband to call attention to her despite her silence, she continually got up from her seat on the platform while her husband was speaking and adjusted the light on the podium so that she was as visible as she could be without actually saying anything. Now, finally, at the very end of the campaign, Lady Bird bowed to her husband's demands and agreed to take the step she dreaded most of all. She agreed to speak at the closing Johnson rally on August 27th, the day before the election, in front of a crowd of some 14,000 people who would be jamming the San Antonio Municipal Auditorium, and in front of microphones that would carry her speech over a statewide radio hookup. At least San Antonio was close enough to Austin so that she could drive there, but this proved a doubtful blessing. She and Mrs. Brooks were going to stop en route for a coffee in Seguin, but before they got there, their car skidded on wet pavement, veered off the road, overturned, and rolled over twice before coming to a stop in a ditch. Lady Bird was bruised and shaken up, but otherwise uninjured, and she didn't want anything to disturb Lyndon before his big rally. Depositing Mrs. Brooks, who was badly bruised, in a hospital, she drove alone to the Seguin reception, borrowed a dress from the hostess to replace her torn clothes, and shook hands with 200 women with her usual smiling graciousness. Then she drove to San Antonio and made her speech. During the next few days, mail poured into the Hancock House from political leaders. Abilene District Chairman J. Taylor wrote, "Lady Bird was wonderful on the radio last night. Should have been on all the time." And from voters, Mrs. W. S. Harris of Hayes County wrote Johnson, "I heard your wife's sweet voice over the radio, and I thought what a comfort she was to you." A Houston attorney and his wife, who had heard Mrs. Johnson's speech, were to write that they were waiting in line at the polling place on the hot, muggy election day, being jostled by unwashed members of our democracy, when his wife turned to him with perspiration streaming down her face and with makeup, hat, and clothing somewhat bedraggled, and said, "I want you to know that I am enduring this only on account of that lovely Mrs. Johnson." After the speech, Lady Bird and Lyndon arrived at their San Antonio hotel room about midnight, and Johnson, as he would later recall, told her we'd better get to bed. But Lady Bird said she was driving back to Austin that night for some last-minute campaigning on Election Day. "As she changed for the trip," Johnson was to recall, "I saw these big bruises." And when he asked her about them, she had to tell him about the accident. But she drove back to Austin and was up early the next morning. She and Lyndon's mother and his sisters divided the Austin telephone book among them, and all Election Day they phoned people asking them to go to the polls and vote. She had a good line ready for reporters who inquired about the accident. "All I could think of, as we were turning over, was I sure wished I'd voted absentee." But she was prouder of the telephone calls, because all day she had managed to talk over the phone to absolute strangers without losing her nerve. Chapter 13. The Stealing. Lyndon Johnson had started the runoff campaign 70,000 votes behind, and the petty votes had at first seemed likely to widen the margin. But almost day by day, it seemed, he was narrowing the gap. And then, suddenly, during the last week or 10 days of the campaign, it wasn't narrowing any further. His young aides weren't aware of this. Amid the noisy bustle in the Hancock House, optimism mounted with each new report from Buzz or Woody of the record crowds Lyndon was drawing and of their enthusiasm. The young men, like Connolly and Herring, believed they were going to win. But in the quiet offices on the 7th floor of the Brown Building, where Alvin Wirtz, Edward Clark, and Everett Looney, the senior partners in the law firms for which the young men worked, met with Herman and George Brown, and whenever he was in Austin with Lyndon Johnson, there was no longer jubilation. The reports coming into the Brown Building weren't from Buzz or Woody, but from more seasoned politicians, men who had watched 100 campaigns, and who knew that crowds were only a part, often a misleading part, of a political story. Furthermore, they were receiving other information not available to the young men, the results of private polls. In these polls, which were being taken almost daily, Johnson had been steadily gaining ground on Coke Stevenson, and then, abruptly, as had been the case in the first primary, he stopped gaining. In a public poll, the Belden poll, released on August 21st, 1 week before the August 28th primary, the two candidates had leveled off, with Stevenson leading Johnson 48% to 41%, with 11% undecided. Among voters considered most likely to vote, and who had a definite preference, Stevenson led Johnson 54% to 46%. These figures, Belden noted, were practically the same as in a poll taken the previous week. A Belden poll released on August 27th showed that there's been no great change in the potential strength of Stevenson and Johnson since the first primary. The men in the Brown Building knew what the polls meant. Johnson had chipped and chipped away at Stevenson's strength, but there was a solid core, a bedrock of belief in Coke Stevenson that had not been touched. Johnson had gained on Coke, but he hadn't gained enough. He was going to come close, but he was going to lose. For these men, it was all on the line now. It was all or nothing, and they knew what they had to do. Campaigning was no good anymore, Ed Clark says. We had to pick up some votes. Votes in the numbers needed couldn't be picked up by conventional methods, he says. We needed blocks, ethnic groups. That was a place to go. That meant going into the Mexican country, the Rio Grande River, the border. Johnson aides made trips down to the valley again. They flew in planes owned by Brown and Root from an air terminal owned by Brown and Root. The name of the company was not on the plane. The terminal was simply called Executive Air Services. Often the man who went was Clark, the secret boss of Texas, the man who knew how to use money without anyone ever seeing the money. People went down half a dozen times by plane, by private plane, Clark says. They landed mostly on private airstrips. I made several trips down there. I didn't stay overnight any time I went down there. There would be no names in a hotel register, no servants in a private home who could remember and later perhaps testify to the presence of these couriers. And they didn't see many people. They didn't have to. In Webb County, Clark says, he saw only one man. Judge Raymond controlled the situation there just like I could take a piece of paper and write my name. He not only appointed the county judge, he appointed the county clerk, the election judges. He controlled the election process. I did not discuss details with him. You didn't have to know what he was going to do or how he was going to do it. You just had to have a diplomatic talk with him and tell him what was needed. Clark says he didn't give money to Raymond or to anyone else. George Parr was left mainly to Alvin Wirtz. Neither of the two men is alive to discuss their dealings, but Louis Salas saw the result. Heavily though Johnson money had been spent before the first primary in the six counties Parr controlled, it was nothing to the way Johnson money was spent now. The Mexican-American political workers soon caught on. Our people sure were spoiled. They wanted money and more money, Salas says. But his patron told him not to balk at any request. As Salas recalls it, Parr told him, Luis, do not hesitate. Spend all the money necessary, but we have to have Johnson elected. The largest single source of ethnic votes was, of course, San Antonio. Before the first primary, Johnson money had been poured lavishly into the Mexican-American slums of San Antonio's West Side. But leaders of the West Side machine had been lackadaisical, and Stevenson, a great favorite among Mexican-Americans because of his championing of their causes during his governorship, and of course the overwhelming favorite in the city's non-Mexican areas, had beaten Johnson in the citywide totals by more than 11,000 votes. Johnson's key man in San Antonio had always been Dan Quill. After the first primary, the postmaster had written Johnson that his organization could do better the second time around, although we will need some money. But no one was more skilled in the purchasing of votes in San Antonio than Lyndon Johnson himself, and he wanted another organization out working for him in San Antonio on the second election day as well, an organization that had never worked for him in the past, that of the city's feared sheriff, Owen Kilday. Dan Quill was a smart little operator, John Connolly says, but the man with the muscle in San Antonio was Owen Kilday. The Kilday organization bore a very high price tag. That was a sophisticated organization, Connolly recalls. Election day work was handled by Kilday's numerous deputy sheriffs. They would be responsible for hiring cars and drivers to round up Mexican Americans and get them to the polls, and to make sure they voted correctly. And, Connolly says, they had a standard rate for a car and a driver, and they were paid handsomely. $250 for some deputies, $500 for others. It takes a hell of a lot of money for an organization like that. Did Johnson spend as much as $50,000 in San Antonio? I wouldn't be surprised, John Connolly said recently. But then he added that while that figure might be correct for the Kilday organization, then, of course, there was Valmo Bellinger, the black boss in San Antonio. He had an organization, too. Valmo had to have some help. Huge sums of Johnson money were poured into the city. Whatever the price of the Kilday organization, and the Bellinger organization, and the Quill organization, Johnson paid it. Quill received a sum of money far greater than he had expected, and he came to realize not only that the Kildays were not fighting us, but that Kilday and his many deputies were working in Johnson's behalf and working hard. Johnson made sure he got his money's worth. The final week of his campaign was a week of spectacle in the state's big cities. Flying into Dallas, Houston, Fort Worth, and San Antonio in a private plane, he was met in each city by cheering, sign-waving campaign workers and a band playing The Eyes of Texas. And then was driven, sitting atop the back seat of an open convertible and waving a Stetson, at the head of a caravan of banner-draped automobiles led by police motorcycles with sirens wailing, to greet crowds in the downtown shopping area and to speak at elaborate rallies that featured 10 star Hollywood entertainers. And, of course, to make the customary 3 broadcasts a day over the statewide network. In San Antonio, the day before the election, the candidate, almost hysterical, shouted at a rally at the city's municipal auditorium that he was 40 years old that very day. "You know, life begins at 40, and I hope to be the next junior senator when I am 40 years and one day old." And masked bands played Happy Birthday. It was the climax of a week of public pageantry, spectacular even in the vivid history of Texas politics. In a motorcade led by police cars filled with dozens of Sheriff Kilday's deputies, and by jeeps bearing immense photographs of himself, driven by uniformed war veterans, Johnson rode through San Antonio, sitting atop the back seat of a convertible, with the Kilday, Congressman Paul, flanking him on one side, and Kilday's deadliest enemy, former Mayor Maury Maverick, flanking him on the other, symbolizing the fact that he had the support of both sides in the city's political wars. This book is continued on Cassette 11, Side 1.